everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, December 15th, 2020. I'm the host of the show, Cara Santamaria. And before we dive into this week's episode, I just want to thank all of you from the bottom of my heart for sticking with me throughout the year. I know it's been a really tough one. Everybody has their unique struggles, their unique circumstances, and of course, this global pandemic has exacerbated all of the difficulties that everyone is facing. I want to, you know, send you my thoughts and my love if you've dealt with loss this year, if you've dealt with difficulty. You really are in my thoughts. And I just want to thank all of you for being here with us in this kind of weird family that we've developed over the years here on Talk Nerdy. I also want to thank those of you who have supported the show over the years in the many ways that you're able to do so, whether that's visiting the Talk Nerdy store, whether that's rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you download the show, or whether that is pledging your support through Patreon. This is my last show of the year. I'll be back after a two-week hiatus, which I take every year over the holidays. But once again, I want to thank those of you who have pledged your support, including Michael Gaucher, Mary Neva, Christopher Pitts, June Sapara, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, Dudas Infinitas, Charles Payet, Brian Holden, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith, Robert Christ, and Elise Christie. Thank you all so, so very much. All right. So I've got an interesting episode for you this week, and I feel like I need to caveat a few things up front. I was able to do a really thrilling interview with the author of a very important book. And not only is he the author of this important book, but he is the investigative journalist that really blew the lid off this story. So his name is Brian Deer, and the book is called The Doctor Who Fooled the World: Science, Deception, and the War on Vaccines. Now, Brian is going to tell us about the investigative work that he did in the UK to really gather a lot of information about Andrew Wakefield's original publications regarding the MMR vaccine, the original accusations of, autism as a result of the MMR vaccine, and where the real fraudulent and really agenda-driven anti-science I can't even think of a stronger word than fraudulent, but just incredibly pseudoscientific, non-scientific actions really took place. I think that ultimately I had hoped to be able to bridge this story and this conversation with the anti-vax rhetoric that we are all struggling with here, especially in the United States, where anti-science has taken a foothold significantly because for unfortunately, at least another month, we are existing under one of the most anti-science, or maybe the most anti-science administration that this country has ever seen. We've got anti-vax quack doctors testifying before the Senate about, you know, not getting the vaccine, about using hydrochloroquine, which is something that we, you know, has been debunked at this point. It's out of step with scientific consensus. We see the rhetoric online. We see a lot of the anti-vax propaganda that's promoted through, celebrity postings, through really concerted and organized efforts that are founded in fraud. They're founded in conspiracy. And I want to make my position known right here at the top of the show that the COVID-19 vaccines that we are seeing become available, and even as I speak, some of these vaccines are becoming available for frontline workers, have gone through the rigors of clinical trials. They have been reviewed by regulatory organizations here in the U.S. and in the other countries like Canada and many countries in Europe who have had access to this data. They are shown to be effective, and they are shown to be safe within within the parameters that are found to be important for public health. So what I'm saying is that no vaccine is without its risks. But when it comes to public health, it's so important that we look at the risk versus benefit analysis. It's a complicated analysis. It requires a lot of layers and a lot of different kind of algorithmic inputs. But one thing that we can say for sure is that the evidence points to the fact that getting vaccinated is the single most important public health measure that we can take to mitigate and eventually, hopefully, minimize or possibly eliminate, but more than likely minimize this global pandemic that has wreaked havoc and death on so many people across the globe. I'm not saying we shouldn't continue to mask, to use proper sanitation and PPE, to maintain social distancing. All of these things are important. But what I'm saying is that as soon as I'm able to, I am going to get this vaccine. And I hope that if you are in a position where you're healthy enough to, and where you're capable of, you know, carrying that torch, I should say, carrying that sort of responsibility for your fellow human being, that this is something that you would seriously consider. I wanted to give these caveats at the top of the show because after Brian and I have a deep conversation and discussion about the story of Andrew Wakefield and the story of the anti-vax movement, I was a little concerned that it ended a bit abruptly. I was a little bit concerned that we weren't able to make that transition into the importance of vaccination, especially to an American audience. I don't want to leave you out if you listen to me and you're not in the States, because I know that a pretty decent size of the audience is actually not here in the United States. But probably if you watch the news, you know what an uphill battle we're dealing with right here. This problem is not solved. It's not a function of there being a knowledge deficit. Once the truth came out that Andrew Wakefield was a fraud, people didn't go, oh, okay, now I'm going to get vaccinated. And that's the really unfortunate moral of this story that Brian and I, you know, we kind of disagreed about a little bit. And honestly, I think that the whole picture wasn't really painted there. So I wanted to say all of this up top just because I felt a real moral obligation to do so. But that said, I think that this is a really important story to be told. And I highly recommend everybody pick up a copy of The Doctor Who Fooled the World, Science Deception and the War on Vaccines. So without any further ado, here he is, award-winning investigative journalist, Brian Deer. Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining me today.
Pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
I have to admit, I'm very excited about this episode in particular. I think it's a perfect way to round out the year for several reasons. One, I've really never done a deep Wakefield dive on the show, which is bizarre because we've been on air now for years and years and years. And number two, as I'm sure you're getting a lot of requests lately around your book, the kind of anti-vax movement is back in the news because of all of the challenges and the interest around the newly developed COVID vaccines that will hopefully be available here in the next month. So, you know, before we fully dive in, I was hoping that maybe you could give me a little bit of your own backstory, how it is that you found yourself doing a deep dive into Andrew Wakefield, into sort of the anti-vax movement as a whole, and really sitting down to work on this book.
Well, it just started as a routine assignment way back in 2003, late 2003. The UK had reached its lowest point of public acceptance of a children's vaccine. That was the 3-in-1 MMR, the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. There'd been since 1998, and even before that a little bit, a declining public confidence in the vaccine brought about by this man, Andrew Wakefield, who'd launched a campaign against it, really, I suppose one could call it that. And by late 2003, the peak vaccination rate of two-year-olds, which had been about, I think it was about 95-96%, way back before he started, had fallen to, I think, in the 70s. And we were starting to be threatened with outbreaks of measles. And there'd been so much coverage of the subject in the UK. It had become It had become essentially the most talked about public health story in Britain over the years before. There'd been enormous media coverage of it. And so I was just given a routine assignment to look at it. It was one of a number of things I discussed with my editor as to what I might do. He'd taken over some feature pages of the paper and wanted people, journalists, who could do sort of stories that would fill a page or maybe two pages if he was lucky. And the MMR vaccine controversy was just such a story. You could have published pretty much anything new on the subject at that time, and it would have got a very good amount of coverage in the paper. So I just began it and started looking at where this controversy that was then raging had begun.
Right. And you had been working as an investigative journalist at the time with some specific focuses on like drugs and medicine. Were you, would you identify as an investigative journalist first and maybe a business or like a science journalist secondarily? Or were you pretty broad based in your investigations?
Well, I'd started off as a general reporter at the Sunday mm-hmm. Times, London, and then I moved into I did a little bit of editing, but then moved into writing for the magazine. And at the time, because obviously the media landscape has changed very dramatically since then, with the rise of social media and the collapse in advertising for newspapers and television, I worked on stories for the magazine where I could spend 6 months, a year, sometimes several years on a story. And so essentially I'd become an investigative reporter, although before that my main subjects were essentially public interest journalism. Sunday newspapers, we have a different regime to the American press in the sense that our Sunday newspapers are standalone, almost entirely standalone newspapers separate from the rest of the week. So the Times of London, the original Times, has publishes on 6 days a week, and then on the Sunday, the Sunday Times publishes. And so as a Sunday newspaper reporter, you work for in a different rhythm to daily newspapers. So you might spend typically would spend a week on a story or a week on three stories, and then I switched to the magazine, and I might, as I say, I might spend 6 months or a year on a story.
Right. So, you know, as you're digging deep into this, and as you mentioned at the time that this was sort of like the hot story, you know, if you opened up and started pulling a thread, you were going to find something new to write about. Maybe you can share with us sort of across the pond, although I do have listeners all over the world, the bulk, probably like 70%, maybe 75% of the listeners to my show are based in the US, and then it probably follows with the English-speaking world, UK, Australia, New Zealand, and so on and so forth. I think here in the US, obviously, we struggle with a massive anti-vax movement, but I'm not sure how many people casually know the story of Andrew Wakefield. I think those of us in the skeptical communities, in the scientific community, are pretty acquainted with it. But I'm not sure. I think a lot of people here might identify anti-vaccine movements with Jenny McCarthy long before they would identify them with Andrew Wakefield. So I think this is a good opportunity to dig deep into who this man was and how in many ways he really became like an architect of this kind of new mentality.
Mm. Well, a lot of people have now heard of him for one reason or another, but the story that most people hear is wrong. The story that is put around not only by anti-vaccine campaigners, but also by people who regard themselves as objective journalists and commentators on these things, is that somehow he was exposed in some way because of his views about vaccines. And this is completely untrue. There was never anything to do with his views about vaccines. And the work that I did was never focused on whether or not what he was saying about vaccines as an opinion was true or false or anything like that. The actual story is one of, well, essentially, it's how an acorn of deception was planted years back, way back in 1998, when he was the first author, and really the only author. He got a lot of people to put their names on it, but basically he was the only author. There were 12 other people whose names he attached to it, but he was the author of a paper that was 4,000 words long across 5 pages of The Lancet. Now, The Lancet is generally considered to be the world's number 2 general medical journal. In the great sort of panoply of biomedical publishing, where you would see, for example, the really big stories, the really big research reports, let me put it that way, about, say, COVID-19, the absolute pinnacle of success for medical researchers would be to get a research report called a paper in Nature, which is a general science journal. Nature or Science, these are the twin general science journals, and they're very, very difficult to get papers about anything published. The number of papers submitted to Nature, Science, and Science are just overwhelming. Of course, they're from everything from astronomy and physics to biology, and so finding a slot for the story about even COVID, you would need to come up with something pretty good. The early papers, the breakthrough papers on HIV, for example, were published in Science, which was a very lofty place to publish. And then when you get below the general science journals, you get to the general medical journals, and they have a ranking with the New England Journals of Medicine at the top. Then after that, you get The Lancet and the Journal of the American Medical Association coming after that, the Annals of Internal Medicine, Cell, and journals such as that. Cell, I suppose, is more of a general science journal. You could say that was number 3 to the to Nature and Science. And so within that context, this paper came from Wakefield, published in The Lancet, the world's number 2 general medical journal. And essentially what it said was there were 12 children he'd and his associates had seen and reported on. It was a case series, which is considered to be a low standard of evidence. It's simply a write-up of clinical cases, apparently, of, in this case, it was children, child patients, who'd come to a bowel clinic in London, the North London Hospital of the Royal Free. And the parents said to the effect of, my child was developing perfectly normally and received his or her, it was 11 boys and 1 girl, in fact, in this paper. The children were all white who were written up in this paper, and they were aged between 3 and 9.5.
And how many did you say there were?
There were 12 in this
12,
paper.
Okay, so small
11,
group.
11 boys and 1 girl. Now, that's not unusual. And there was a lot of criticism when the paper was first published in February 1998. The medical establishment and journalists and who followed the medical establishment, and indeed authors of books, some of whom who plagiarized my early work on this because I've been working on it a long time, said, "Oh well, why would anybody take any notice of a paper with just 12 children? That's not a basis for anything." That is completely wrong. If you take, for example, Crohn's disease, a terrible inflammatory bowel disease with which Wakefield was at the time a researcher, that was first classically described in 1932 by a group of doctors in New York on 14 patients. Autism was published first in a systematized way in 1943 based on 11 children. In the Baltimore area, the Johns Hopkins University, which actually is the publisher of my book, The Doctor Who Fooled the World. AIDS, 1981, published on 5 gay men in Los Angeles.
Oh, wow.
So it's nothing unusual about the fact that there were only 12 children in this paper. No reason to dismiss it at all, because these parents turned up and they said, my child was developing perfectly normally, received the MMR vaccine, and within 14 days, very specifically, within 14 days, 2 weeks of that, and with the time spread from immediately to 14 days across the spread of those 12 children. My child was developing perfectly normally, and within those 2 weeks showed the first symptoms of autism. Now, if that was true, if that scenario was true, that a group of families had turned up and with their children, and they'd all made this very similar story, at face value, that might be the first snapshot of a hidden epidemic of catastrophic injuries.
Right.
That doctors at other hospitals around the world just didn't notice that these people, this particular team of doctors in London was so sharp or so astute or so lucky or whatever it is, because they also, and they added at the end of this paper that there were another 40 children they said they'd seen, 39 of whom had the same issue, just written as like a paragraph at the end. At face value, that could be something very, very serious indeed. So these 12 children are written up in The Lancet, 14 days, and there was responsible media that night. All the television networks covered it. The paper itself said, well, nothing was proved about a link between MMR and autism, but it described autism as it had two tables, and it described autism as affecting 9 of the 12 children. And it said that in 8 of the cases reported in the paper, there was this link, a 14-day link. And that when you looked at the paper, you saw it being described as the MMR being described as the apparent precipitating event for these children's autism. And you saw in the tables columns of children where it would go autism, 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 autism. And then the next column, it would be MMR, 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 MMR. There could be no question what this paper was meant to be telling you and was right. telling you that that the MMR vaccine was, on the basis of this these children just turning up at the hospital with their parents, like random routine patients, that there was a link between the two, this temporal link between the two. And the paper actually pointed that out very strongly. And the hospital and the medical school, which was attached to the hospital where this man, Andrew Wakefield, worked, was persuaded by Wakefield and his head of department, who was the professor of gastroenterology at the hospital, to hold a press conference. Now, press conferences are normally reserved kind of for things like the reporting of new diseases or new treatments or doctor's pay or something else that's absolutely crucial to medicine, and not just speculation. So they had this press conference and the media all turned up and the dean of the medical school presided over the press conference. And at this press conference, Andrew Wakefield said that he believed the government should suspend the MMR vaccine because, as a matter of moral conscience, he said, he couldn't continue to support this vaccine, this 3-in-1 vaccine. And the professor of gastroenterology supported him, saying that there appeared to be something unusual about giving 3 viruses together in a vaccine, because the MMR vaccine contains live viruses of measles, mumps, and rubella, as a way of promoting vaccination, different technology to what they're talking about with COVID.
Was that the only combined live vaccine that most children were receiving?
It's the only combined live vaccine.
Okay.
There were other vaccines which are live, but that's the only combined live one. It's not the only combined one, but it's the only combined live one. So you get these three weakened or attenuated viruses given together in this vaccine as a way to prevent those 3 illnesses. And there was media coverage that night. All the networks covered it. Newspapers mostly covered it the next day. Nothing particularly dramatic. One newspaper, The Guardian, did 3 stories beginning on the front. And this set off the beginning of a public health scare really unrivaled since the early years of AIDS. And as I say, it was the acorn from which the modern anti-vaccine movement has emerged. Now, people, as I say, criticized it. They said, well, you know, what can you say based on 12 children? This is all exaggerated. And many doctors who sought to criticize the paper turned their attention on the media and said it was irresponsible for journalists to be saying things about this paper and reporting it and giving it great credence. There even today, somebody wrote a review of my book saying, oh, well, the paper was overinterpreted. Well, it wasn't overinterpreted because, as I say, at the time, and I didn't write about it at the beginning, this is before I ever got involved, it wasn't overinterpreted. It was fairly interpreted as being a potential signal of something possibly associated with the MMR vaccine that warranted further inquiry. And then Wakefield and his associates at this hospital in London set themselves up as essentially preoccupied with trying to prove that hypothesis that the MMR vaccine caused autism.
Right. There was clear intent there in the publication and then in the preceding actions of Wakefield and his colleagues.
Yes, to alert the world to this apparent link. And as I say, he called on the government to suspend the vaccine, and they produced a video recording, a 21-minute, or was it 23-minute video news release, which they distributed to newspapers, held a press conference, they held rehearsals for it, they put in extra phone lines, because this was in 1998, which was really before mobile phones were really, really portable and had good battery power and what have you. So they put in extra phone lines to alert the public. They put in mechanical answering machines to field the public's anxiety because they knew what they were doing. They were shouting bomb in a crowded place. So there we are. So at face value, you had this this health storm which had been set off from this hospital, and the British public became very concerned. Young parents became worried when their time came for their child to be due their MMR, which is usually around about a year old or 14 months old. And there we are. There was the story. It was running very big. It ran for years. And then in 2003, 5 years later, I was given a routine assignment to look at the impact of all this and really what it was all about. And I had no particular agenda to find anything particular about it. There was this Wakefield man was appearing at the time in a docudrama film on British television, which I later discovered was paid for by anti-vaccine campaigners in the United States. In fact, that story's never been written up. I got so busy with other things.
Oh, wow.
Because that would have been, been a breach of British broadcasting law, the fact that that was never disclosed to the public. So there we are. So that was the situation. I came along, and really quite soon I discovered that the story that had been presented was initially misleading and ultimately a deception, and furthermore fraud, that this paper was a concoction and had been devised with fraudulent intent. And how that came about was the next part of the story.
This paper was first published, as you mentioned, in 98, right? Just trying to get the time down. And then you started doing some investigation in the early 2000s. And we know that Wakefield has been, you know, active in this sort of movement basically this entire time. We continue to see, like, there's a recent documentary that came out featuring him, like a propaganda documentary. We've continued to see that the sort of the agenda that's been pushed has continued to be pushed throughout this. So I guess what I'm asking is, when you first sat down to start writing about this story, was it mostly about the original publication and some of the original fallout from the late 90s?
Oh, no, that would be totally uninteresting. No, my mission as a Sunday newspaper journalist, and I would have the aphorism that my checklist for if something is a matter of potential interest, I would ask, is it new? Is it true? Do we have it to ourselves? So I wouldn't write up an old story. I'm a newspaper reporter. So, I mean, I wouldn't write up an old story. The, what I was giving you then was the picture as it stood, the public record as it stood when I began. And the so then, I mean, and that public picture, everybody wrote about that there was this paper and there was this thing and this happened and there was this press conference and people said they shouldn't have had a press conference and should they or shouldn't they? And Wakeford then went on to publish other papers saying more or less the same thing.
But so, sorry to interject, but I'm wondering, like, at the time when this was, you know, originally controversial, but sort of, like you said, there was a misunderstanding or at least an, or maybe an intentional kind of confusion around sort of intent, right? Like, was this misinterpreted? Did people interpret it too deeply? No, this is what the paper said. But what was Wakefield's forward-facing stance at the time? Was he like, no, you're reading too deeply into what I'm saying? Or was he like, no, hands down, I'm telling you the MMR vaccine is dangerous and I'm the only guy who holds the true key?
Well, at face to the public, forward-facing to the public, he was saying, we haven't proved anything. I have a concern. I think the vaccine should be suspended while we pursue further investigation.
Okay. So he seemed like he was very scientific about this and he was kind of hedging and tempering.
Yeah. Okay. He appeared to be an independent researcher working at a London medical school, not a particularly good medical school, but there we are. But there he was. It had Royal in its title. So so it sounded quite good. So that was the record and the public debate or the professional debate was, well, you know, it's just one paper and there's we've given hundreds of thousands of millions of vaccines to children. And you would expect to see an association between the MMR vaccine and the first symptoms of autism because they both happen at more or less the same time. The first recognition of something unusual or some suspicion of autism very often occurs in early in the second year of life. So the medical establishment and the scientific community would say, well, you would expect that, wouldn't you? But nevertheless, there was no real explanation for how these 12 children all turned up there and the picture emerged the way it did. And that really was what interested me because right. I had a background in investigating pharmaceutical companies, firstly, and also medical misconduct. And I'd done quite a number of investigations there was one point I got a journalism award, quite a good one. I can actually look at my wall here now and see my name on this this press award. Just above the one underneath it. But anyway, so I got a journalism award and the citation said I was probably the only journalist in Britain who polices the drugs companies.
Right.
That's what it said. Whether that's true or not, I mean, not for me to judge or brag or anything like that, but that's what it said. That's what I was known for, investigating drug companies. And I was also very interested in the scientific method and the scientific rigor that goes on behind these things. Because my first ever investigation into the pharmaceutical industry was in 1996, where I came upon the case of a man named Michael Briggs, who fabricated a whole series of papers on what was then a new generation of contraceptive pills. And he just basically sat at his desk. He was doing this in Geelong, in Australia, just west of Melbourne in Australia. And he made up these papers, including research on beagle dogs, mostly on women, though. And he simply made up papers and published them. And I ultimately tracked him down. He went into hiding, and I found him in Marbella, Spain, what in Britain we call the Costa del Crime, because so many people who are wanted by the police used to go to Marbella. I turned up at his door and interviewed him, and it was quite a good interview, really. I was relatively inexperienced at those kind of stories at the time, but my editor said to me, what you need to do is you need to take two tape recorders. And I said, well, why do I need two tape recorders? And he said, well, what you do is you ask if you can record, and if they say no, you've got another one in your pocket, and
right.
you can do that. That's this is perfectly legal in the UK. In parts of the United States, it is actually illegal. I mean, if you did that in California, you'd be in trouble. Well, you'd be in difficulty because, and without asking permission, you would need permission of the other party to do it. But where I was doing it, there was nothing wrong with that. So, of course, yeah, I put the tape recorder on the table, said, can I record this? And he said, no. So I had the other one going. And I had this long interview, and at the end of which this scientist's wife, who was a family doctor, she started sort of hissing at me. Yes, you say these things, but what can you prove? What can you prove? And, well, we could prove it. And we also got the whole interview, everything he said. We got all the documents. And he threatened to sue us, threatened to sue the Sunday Times, which is usually what these people do. Ultimately, he drank himself to death. I think it was about 3 months later he died, and having drunk himself to death. And I became very interested in that, not only in the pharmaceutical industry, but also the method, because there's all this great outpouring of scientific papers. Mm-hmm. And you just wonder, well, what about them? I mean, who speaks for their truth? Because you assume, you know, there's papers being handed down all the time on COVID-19, and
they're fast-tracked, well, and they're kind of they're kind of skirting peer review.
Exactly.
And even if something goes through peer review, like we saw with Wakefield's study.
Well, yeah, I was going to talk. Yeah, we can talk about peer and the peer review. I find really interesting. But I've had a lot of trouble in being allowed to write about it, because every time I try to write about the issues that I'm now discussing, as opposed to, you know, the MMR thing, which everybody assumes means, oh, I'm pro-vaccine and I'm campaigning, but I'm not. I mean, I didn't take any view. I never take any public positions on whether any pharmaceutical product, vaccines, or anything else causes this or that or anything the other. It's just not what I'm interested in. And I wasn't even interested. It wasn't even the vaccine that I was interested in the first place with Wakefield, but I was interested in really this question that I ask in my book, which is, if he could do what he did, and as I say in the book, and I'll show you what he did, who else is doing what in the hospitals and laboratories that we may one day look to for our lives? And I wrote that before the COVID outbreak, and I can cross out now one day, because now this is what we're looking to for our lives. We're looking to hospitals and laboratories. So if he could do what he did, what could we be doing now? But I am not allowed to say that. I was asked to write a piece around this kind of issue by Nature, and when I wrote it, they rejected it. They said, you can't say that. This is the house magazine of science. They rejected it. More recently, the British Medical Journal, with whom I've had a very good relationship, invited me to write a piece. I wrote it and they rejected it. And then Sunday Times, which I've worked for since 1981, asked me to do a piece. I put in some of my comment points. Came back, oh no, well, it's in news this week, so we don't want to cut it.
It makes me wonder if the reason that a lot of the pushback, and sorry that this is sort of an aside, is because it's such a tricky question, you know, about First Amendment protections and things of that nature, but because here, at least in the US, our leadership has shown such a strong anti-science bent that there is this distrust in institutions that, yes, of course, we should always question. And yes, of course, we should always make sure that we have, you know, good, hardworking journalists like yourself exposing fraud and exposing the problem so that we can make the system stronger. But there's a fear, I think, that some people in the general public now would read about fraud and think, okay, then I can't trust any of the institutions at all.
Yes, I mean, and that's a big problem in terms of media these days, mm-hmm. because simply there isn't the resources around to do these kind of investigations. I mean, I would never have been able to. I spent my first story in the Sunday Times on the Wakefield issue took me 4 months, and there's absolutely no way in the world would I have got 4 months' time to work on that story if it hadn't been about a children's vaccine and it hadn't been about linked to a story that was absolutely the top of the medical agenda, if you like. No way.
It's not just about public trust at this point, but I think it's also obviously about the funding. But I do want to come back to that maybe at the end of our hour to talk about sort of public sentiment with regards to vaccines and how it's been shaped, you know, over the course of this conversation by by people like Wakefield and like all of the sort of disciples that came after. Because I think that now is a time when people are really scared. And I think that, you know, that's an important conversation to have. But maybe kind of going back to what we were talking about, when you started digging deep and when you saw, you know, kind of the real story begin to unfold, tell me a little bit more about what you began to learn as your investigation.
So this paper, which, as I say, appeared to be just a write-up, a case series of children turning up randomly at this hospital, wasn't anything of the sort. Well, the first thing I discovered was that the children who featured in the paper and the parents who brought them there weren't just people turning up at a children's bowel clinic, but had actually been referred to the hospital by an anti-vaccine campaign group. And this campaign group had been set up by a mother who had to, as a matter of British law. We have something called the Legal Aid Fund, which is administered by an ever-changing named group organizations, government fund, which funds people to sue who can't afford to do so. And okay. Children are always considered to be poor, so always eligible. And this mother wanted to sue the manufacturer of the MMR vaccine because she believed, I have to say, with not a lot of evidence, because the record suggests that the MMR vaccine was never even delivered to the doctor's office where she took her child to be vaccinated.
There's a big hole in her case.
That's a little bit of a difficulty, and she'd got a batch number which she put into her lawsuit, and the batch number was the batch number of a tetanus vaccine. But anyway, so just leaving that aside, but she had to get lots and lots of other parents to say the same thing. Otherwise, she was never going to get funded to bring a lawsuit, because to bring a lawsuit against a drug company is one expensive thing, especially over something, a contested area of medicine. You want to try suing a drug company, they're going to come at you in ways you can't imagine. So she had to do that, but she'd referred the parents and their children to Wakefield at that hospital. So these weren't just random parents turning up and by coincidence telling an alarmingly similar story. They were an orchestrated group sent there for a purpose. So that's the first thing I learned. The second thing I learned, that Wakefield himself was being paid by a lawyer to make exactly the case that appears in that paper. And he, too, was being funded from the Legal Aid Fund. Later, I discovered the full amount. In modern US dollars, it was about $800,000 he got in the end for activities.
Yeah, there's some motivation.
And he was being paid at hourly rates. And the contract had begun 2 years before the paper was published. And his agreement to do it had begun before a single child had been brought to the hospital. So he had this monstrous conflict of interest. I also then at the next stage, it was like peeling an onion. At the next stage, I discovered that he'd filed for his own patent on a single measles vaccine, on his own vaccine, 8 months before he announced at this press conference that he believed people should boycott the MMR and the government should suspend it in favor of single vaccines. So again, another monstrous conflict of interest, which, like his funding by the lawyer and his relationship with the lawyer and the state of the children, was never revealed to the public until I revealed it years later. And then once I'd done all that, the issues involving that were so serious that the British government, the health secretary, said, I believe this should be investigated by a body we call the General Medical Council, which is essentially the medical board for all doctors in the UK. And so they began an investigation at the same time as which Wakefield sued me and sued a television network, the Channel 4 network here, which had broadcast an hour-long documentary by me, which I reported, taking the story forward, which not only showed that that he had this his own measles vaccine patent, but also that the theory behind his claims, which was that it was the live measles virus in the MMR that was responsible, had been refuted by his own laboratory, which had failed to find any evidence of measles in any of these children or any connection at all. They were using the polymerase chain reaction, which people have heard a lot probably about in the media now, because it's the foundation for a lot of the COVID-19 infection tests. It's a molecular technology, very sophisticated. So I discovered that. And then as a result of Wakefield suing me, I was able to obtain a lot of information, huge amount of information, which showed that the paper, the data behind the paper was fraudulent. And the only problem was that he discontinued his lawsuit against us and against me on the very day that I was sitting in a doctor's office, in a lawyer's office, reading the unredacted medical records, which we'd obtained from him by a court order. He threatened to sue us, then tried to suspend the action because he wanted to be able to tell people he was suing us but not actually go through with it.
Right.
So we effectively sued him and got the court to order him to proceed to trial. And in the course of that, we had massive documents disclosed, which I couldn't then use because they remained sealed. Because he then discontinued his action and I couldn't then use the document.
So you could see them, but you couldn't use them to support your argument.
That's right. But then two things happened. One was that there was the medical board had a massive disciplinary hearing where the children's medical records were set out. It was the longest ever such hearing. It ran for 217 days, which made it longer than the trial of O.J. Simpson. It was spread out over 2.5 years. And I sat through much of that and was able to move from the records of the children that were being read aloud over and over into the public record. I was the only journalist there. I was able to take all that into my notebooks and show what Wakefield did. And then he sued me again in Texas over some stories I wrote for the British Medical Journal. And the combination of those two factors meant that I was able to get the complete medical records of the children in a form that I could use. And because he sued against me in Texas, I was able to lift the seal on the documents and the things that I'd seen in the London hearings and was able to reveal that, in fact, the paper was fraudulent. What he'd done was not only conceal who these children were and how he'd found them, and not only been hired by a lawyer to do precisely this in a way that was not disclosed, and that's in breach of medical. There are standards of publishing for medical journals. It's not just, you know, what you can get away with. There's specific rules about the disclosure of the sources of children and funding and all those things, all of which he breached. I then discovered that he changed the histories of children so that one child who the mother had said had problems some weeks after MMR, he changed that to immediately and reported it as the next day. There was a father who came from, in fact, the Bay Area of California. It was American. I didn't say there was an American child in the 12. And the father had said that his son's problems had begun, I think, a couple of months after the MMR. And Wakefield changed that to 1 week. And that mother that I'm telling you about, when I ultimately, she came forward and approached me, said that I can see this paper was fraudulent. I can see that from what was written about my own child. She'd been complaining to Wakefield and complaining to Wakefield's lawyers about what it said about her child. The American father said this paper was an outright fabrication based on what he'd seen. And I was able to show that in other cases as well, Wakefield had altered diagnoses. He wasn't even a clinician. I mean, Wakefield was himself, oddly enough, he trained as a surgeon, and he was changing the diagnoses of developmental pediatricians and pediatric neurologists, people who were trained in developmental issues and issues such as autism, changing the diagnoses to make it appear that he'd found some new, what he called a new syndrome, which basically was what you need to admit in evidence in lawsuits. So he changed their diagnoses, he changed their histories, he'd concealed the fact that various blood tests and things on the children had all come back normal. He misrepresented what were normal clinical findings on patients, on children. He misrepresented them as pathology, as saying that this was evidence of disease. And when I was able to get all that, I could show that these children didn't have any evidence of any such disease. But the thing that they were most, the principal gastrological symptoms was that the overwhelming majority, I think 10 of the 12, were suffering from severe constipation. And all that was concealed. Constipation was never mentioned. The proper descriptions of the alleged bowel things that he found were left out. And the whole thing was a concoction to try and create enough public concern that the British government's legal aid fund would have no choice but to fund a lawsuit. And so that paper was published in February, and the lawsuit finally went ahead with the first claims against the drug companies that following October. And ultimately, that lawsuit, which failed shortly before I became involved in the investigation, like about 3 weeks before it failed. After I'd been signed to look at it, thinking there was going to be a court hearing that I could just go to, the hearing was cancelled. The case was failed. The whole thing collapsed, and the final cost of it. It's difficult because if you try and bring it forward today, and you've got to convert sterling into US dollars, which most people around the world knows what a US dollar is worth roughly against their own currency. So if we try and convert it from sterling to US dollars, and we try and convert it from the amounts of money were being spent at the time in the early 2000s to what that would cost now.
Right.
Today, this lawsuit that collapsed, trying to make a case that the MMR vaccine caused autism, racked up a bill for both sides combined of about $100 million.
Holy wow.
And that went right down the toilet. It accomplished nothing for the children. Children got nothing. That was money that all went into the pockets of lawyers and doctors. But that $100 million lawsuit was the financial engine that then allowed the public alarm to be transmitted and translated from the UK to the United States. And so it took off in the United States. And a lawsuit in what's known as the vaccine court, where there's a – in 1986, there was a change in the law which set up the vaccine court in Washington, D.C. It's a kind of a no-fault compensation scheme. And where there's any dispute, there's a panel of special masters who look at these cases, who are specialists who look at just the vaccine reactions and the stories and what have you.
Right, that there are potential reactions in small percentages of individuals. Yes. But that we also know that the kind of public good of these vaccines often outweighs the immediate and minor risk. So there's an avenue for people to be compensated if they unfortunately are victims of that risk.
Well, or if they appear to be.
Right.
If it's plausible, if on the probability they might have, then you get a financial settlement.
And so up to this point, was the anti-vax kind of mentality still quite free? I mean, I can imagine that there were always people who were vaccine hesitant, who, you know, had like conspiratorial thoughts about vaccines. But was this more of like a fringe mentality up to this point?
It was nothing to what it is now.
Right.
But the story continues, and I don't really think we can go into it now. But Wakefield then continued where he moved to the United States and continued his campaigning and began a whole new lease of life. The American lawsuits failed. I wouldn't say they were laughed out of court, but they. If you'd seen the expressions on the faces of the judicial officers hearing the cases, and I did because I went to watch,
right?
They were just incredulous at what had been brought on. That they failed. I think there was 5,500. There were 1,600 families in the UK sued. In the United States, though, I think it was 5,500. At that time.
Jeez.
And that failed in in 2000.
So
and,
obviously the snowball had grown. It had collected momentum. There were people who were sort of latching on, even though at this point, had the study been retracted yet? Did we know that it was fully fraudulent yet?
The first story that I published in the Sunday Times that basically alleged fraud was in 2009, February 2009.
Okay.
So that was the first big shot.
Right.
And the headline was MMR doctor fixed data on autism.
And when did the kind of movement come into the US? When did those lawsuits start?
It started to migrate with him because there were also hearings in the Committee of the House of Representatives, which Wakefield turned up at. See, one of the extraordinary things is that the United Kingdom is not known for many things these days. I mean, it's number three in arms sales. It's number five, I think, in pharmaceuticals, but it's number one in vaccine scares, and that's one of the things that we export to the world. So we exported the fear of the smallpox vaccine in the late 19th century. We exported fear of the DTP vaccine in the 1970s and 1980s, and that's what led to the vaccine court being set up in the United States when an American TV documentary, well, it wasn't really fully documentary, it was an NBC special called Vaccine Roulette, essentially repeated the controversy that had been going on in the UK and moved it over to the United States. And then the MMR scare. And the DTP scare started at a hospital 3.5 miles south of where Wakefield was working. So it's quite a cozy relationship.
Oh, wow. But yeah, but I guess I'm trying to be clear on the timeline of like, when was the public in a position where the evidence was at least available to us that this was all a big scam? Because the crazy thing about this story, it's sort of like we talk about when it comes to journalism, it's very easy to publish a claim, but that cycles throughout the world. But then when you publish the retraction, like nobody reads it. It doesn't resonate with people, unfortunately. It's hard to put
the
genie
back
in the bottle.
Well, it wasn't like that in the UK. No, it wasn't like that in the UK. In the UK, as soon as we published our first story, basically, in the Sunday Times, and the headline was MMR research, revealed MMR research scandal. And all the other newspapers covered the story ahead because it's a complicated story, but the Lancet tried to sabotage my investigation. And in trying to sabotage it, provoked so much interest that the whole thing just exploded in a big bang.
Yeah,
so
helpful.
Vaccination rates started to recover immediately on publication of the first stories and the media coverage that surrounded it.
Okay.
And so people say today, well, you know, what can we do to provoke confidence in vaccines? And I say, well, you know, tell the story. What I've done in my book, The Doctor Who Filled the World, is to tell the story of the real people and the specific facts. We've got all kinds of people out there now who are like holding forth about all kinds of zeitgeist issues and, you know, holding forth about the anti-vaccine movement without ever really working out where it came from and how it all worked. I mean, it was a story. It was something that real people did. We revealed that in 2004, and that started the correction in the UK. And then in 2009, it was MMR doctor fixed autism data. And then in 2010, Wakefield was struck off the medical register for fraud and dishonesty in his research, plus a whole list of other charges, which usually people get more excited about than the fraud and dishonesty ones, but the whole list of great shopping list of charges: abuse of children, misrepresenting himself as a clinician, and all sorts of other things. And so that then reinforced this trend. And the Lancet was then, having fought me, having tried to sabotage my investigation, then was forced to retract the paper fully because it had, I mean, among other things, the clearest slam dunk was that the paper claimed that the research had been approved by an ethics committee, an institutional review board, and it hadn't been. That was an outright lie.
Oh, right there. Yeah. Paper should never go to print if it's.
Yeah. So you could retract it just on the basis of that, because the Lancet didn't want to get, the Lancet did everything it could. And the editor of the Lancet, who tragically, he's now got quite advanced malignant melanoma. So, I mean, I gain no pleasure in rubbishing him, and I hope he doesn't hear me talking about him, because you know, those kind of things are only worsened by stress. But it is a fact that the Lancet sought to sabotage my investigation in order really to protect itself, and that's a very important lesson for people about the way medical publishing operates. And we can't go into the whole thing about, I don't even got time to go into the whole thing about peer review and all that.
Right. But that's really unfortunate to hear. I mean, it's like we often, the sort of faith that keeps us going in the scientific method itself, the actual method of science, is that there's, you know, a lot of space for self-correction, and that, you know, all of the different colleagues who are sort of in competition with each other keep each other honest, you know, that it's our jobs, whether it's as a journal editor or whether it's as a scientific colleague, to read somebody else's work critically and say, I don't get this. This doesn't make sense to me. I don't think you've proven your point. And it's unfortunate when we hear that just is failing left and right.
Well, I mean, you've almost answered your own question there. I mean, somebody reading something and saying, this doesn't make sense to me. Well, that's fair deal, isn't it? I mean, that's what peer review's for.
Mm-hmm.
But what peer review isn't is a test of truth. It's a test of plausibility.
Right, because there's almost a gentleman's agreement that we're all doing this for the same reasons. I mean, why would you ever fabricate data? Like, it's just that's so beyond the pale.
Well, you haven't got the data. Those 12 children, to the best of my knowledge, no journalist has ever anywhere, and I keep asking this, if anyone knows one, I mean, or some story, I mean, I'd be really interested to hear it, because then I could like look at it and, you know, compare and contrast. But I'm not aware of any other journalist who has ever got the original raw data on a piece of published biomedical research. And I got it all. I got the children's identities. I got what was wrong with them, their diagnosis, their clinical histories, their pathology tests, their blood results, every last thing about those 12 children I got.
Right, yeah. In this country, now, that's all protected information.
Well, it is everywhere.
Sure.
It is everywhere. No, it is here as well. It's protected here. I mean, it's protected here. This is material of the greatest confidentiality. Mm-hmm. But I got it by completely legitimate means.
Right.
Completely open, honest, and legitimate means. I was able to put together my own work with stuff that had been published. But most importantly, the hearing of the General Medical Council, which I had triggered through my investigation, through Wakefield suing me, through us getting court orders against him, I would think the cost of the activities that underlie the doctor who fooled the world, including the General Medical Council, lawsuits and all that kind of stuff, leaving aside the lawsuits over MMR, I would say you've got to be talking 10 to 15 million pounds, which I don't know what's that in dollars, say
more,
approaching $20 million.
Yeah.
Just to go through the transcript for a 217-day hearing must have cost more than $1 million, because you've got highly skilled medical stenographers just sitting through the hearing, let alone all the lawyers who are sitting there, this enormous gathering of this room full of lawyers sitting around a rectangle of 17 tables surrounded by piles of confidential medical records, which are read aloud with me sitting there. And they read them over and over again, so there couldn't be any doubt, and ultimately published a 6 million word transcript. So that's the enormous cost of getting behind one of these papers. But peer review, to go back to that point, is a test of plausibility. It's whether, oh, yeah, I've read it, and that doesn't make sense to me. Oh, this is an old story. I've read that before. This figure here is inconsistent with that. And there's been a bit of an interest also these days in certain elements of fraud, misrepresentation, mostly in the area of image manipulation, where somebody's reading an article in a journal and they say, right, well, let's look at that photograph there. These bands, these gel bands, they often are, and we'll compare that with another one. And by comparing illustrations, published illustrations, there's been a fair amount of fraud that has been detected. But in terms of original data, you just don't get it. And not only because it's simply, and in the case of Wakefield's paper, the clinical peer reviewer was a man named David Candy, a professor of pediatric gastroenterology. And he said to me, well, I approved it because the senior author of the paper was a particular professor who had his name at the back end of the paper. And he said, well, he was my mentor and I knew that anything he wrote would be good. This peer reviewer was completely bamboozled. But you see, even people in the business think that that peer review is something that it isn't.
Right.
So when I went to my publishers, my North American publishers, who are the lead publishers, I've now got, I think, seven publishers, but I mean the lead publisher, Johns Hopkins University, mm-hmm. which is obviously the big name at the moment because of its involvement in the COVID epidemiology and tracking the pandemic. The publishing director, I'd been running a little campaign. The proposal for the book was peer reviewed. Then the manuscript was peer reviewed, and I said, well, I want it to be checked as well. Peer review isn't good enough. So the manuscript of the book had 2,000 footnotes. So virtually every sentence had a footnote taking you to the document. So that, for example, if I had the manuscript open now, I could within seconds produce the document in front of me for any particular statement.
Right.
And so there's this archive of more than 2,000 documents, which is taken from an even bigger archive of 12,000 documents, and a lot of the other stuff, you know, you can't get it all. So, and then all that was stripped out because people don't want to sit and read footnotes, and to put them all the references in the book would have doubled the size of the book. But they had to be done because Wakefield, being the person that he is, we needed to be prepared for the possibility of him suing us vexatiously, as he'd done in the past, which mm-hmm. would be very time-consuming. And I wanted it to be clear that my story in The Doctor Who Fooled the World is true, not just that it's plausible.
Right.
So I said to the publishing director, I rang him up one day, I think it was a Friday afternoon, and everyone else had gone home. And I said to him, well, how do you know it's true? And he said, well, it's been peer-reviewed. And I said, yes, but that's a test of plausibility. It's not a test of truth. And he said, oh, well, yeah, but we had this, we mentioned some committee. And I said, yeah, well, how would they know? So I said, well, you know, I'm really, really turning the screws on, because they'd already kind of, further down the line, they'd agreed to perform a checking exercise. And ultimately, they assigned two people to go through all of these 2,000 documents and check them against the text to show that the book was actually true, that Wakefield did have this contract. He was working for lawyers. He did start working for lawyers before the journalist. He did set up a network of companies to try and exploit the scare that he'd created. He wanted to sell his own vaccine and diagnostic kits and all kinds of other stuff. Another thing that I revealed and nobody knew about until we reported it. So this peer review thing is very misleading. So when we had this situation just in June, wasn't there, when Surgisphere, there was a company called Surgisphere, and a group of alleged scientists working with them published two papers, one in the New England Journal of Medicine and the world's number one medical journal, and the other one in The Lancet, and it turned out to be complete nonsense. They were claiming to be giving data. This is on COVID-19, the outcomes for patients with COVID-19 in hospitals. And they claimed they had data from thousands of patients at hundreds of hospitals around the world. And both of these papers were retracted by The Lancet and the New England Journal of Medicine on the same day, within hours of each other. You know, and this is so right in the middle of this COVID issue, there is junk being published that has been peer reviewed. I mean, how that stuff got through peer review, because ultimately it was exposed by, I mean, firstly, there was a write-in by all kinds of people around the world saying, you know, we don't believe this. And then ultimately it was cracked when three Guardian journalists, one in Australia, one in the UK, one in the United States, essentially Googled the company and went into the Wayback Machine to look at the background of the company and found that you know, the whole thing was garbage. And the editor of The Lancet, who in my case had covered up the whole thing, in this case was quick off the mark to say, well, this was completely fraudulent. So peer review just doesn't do it.
Right. It does. I mean, hopefully it continues to do to the best extent possible, given that everybody is sort of, you know, in it together. It continues to do what it's meant to do. But it was, I guess, never really meant to be a fact-checking tool. It was meant to be a tool by which individual colleagues, scientists within the same field, could say, okay, it looks like you did your homework. The arguments that you're making seem like they're not out of left field. It seems like it's you know, satisfactory with regard to the claims that you're making. And then we're going to let the scientific community decide, once it goes to press, you know, how much clout it should really get and how much it's going to change the needle. Unfortunately, you know, what you've really uncovered and proven with Wakefield, among others, is that when somebody wants to commit fraud and they are, you know, they're financially motivated to do so, they're motivated for, you know, I don't even know, megalomaniacally motivated to do so, narcissistically motivated to do so, they're going to be able to figure out how to do it. And it's important that there are individuals in positions like your own, positions that are losing their funding, hemorrhaging their funding, to be able to do those deep investigations.
I believe that in the case of Wakefield, the case of Wakefield is a classic example of what I've long believed. And it's probably my closing argument, really. I've long believed, right, years back, 30 years I've believed this, that there ought to be spot checks, and that at the hospital and medical school where he worked, the management of that, when the controversy erupted, the management should have been in a position to send in specialists, including statisticians and clinicians and scientists in the relevant area, to require that the data be produced and to inspect the data. And I do that in the knowledge that that prisons are subject to that kind of inspection, that in the UK at least, schools are subject to unannounced spot checks to find out what the quality of their work is. Restaurants are subject to unannounced spot checks. And I believe that anywhere that biomedical research is being prepared and for publication, the management or a national body, or indeed these days, I think in the case of COVID, an international body should be able to send in inspectors to look at the data and check that it's all on the up and up. And the response I get from that, for example, I think the editor at Nature, not the top editor, but the editor dealing with me at Nature, said this to me several years ago. He said, you can't say this. This is the house magazine of science. And to suggest that, as I did in my copy, that there's no prima facie reason to suppose that medical scientists, medical researchers are more honest than restaurant managers. And they said, you cannot say that. And I do say that. I do say that. Why? What is the assumption? Is it a class-based thing? Is it a professional-based thing? What is it? You know, and if a restaurant manager runs a shoddy practice, you might find a few people get food poisoned. Somebody might die in an extremely rare case. But in laboratories, the consequences for public health could be catastrophic. So I believe, you know, in the United States, people who are funded by the essentially from the NIH, but with federal money, are entitled to some kinds of inspections from the Office of Research Integrity, but they don't do much.
One of the points that you make that's really important there is that, you know, science is not one size fits all. Biomedical research, for example, has a direct consequence to health and human prosperity. And so I think it's important that, you know, the rules that apply to a study on string theory are different than the rules that apply to, you know, a study, a biomedical study. I think the second thing that's important to point out is that although we do have these kinds of securities in place when it comes to vaccine development, when it comes to drug development, things have to go through clinical trial. The raw data must be produced. You know, there are governing bodies that approve these things based on the claims that have to be backed by solid evidence by the drug companies. It's very different when somebody comes out and says, let's distrust this drug. Let's stop doing something that has been important for public health and sows a lot of discontent amongst the electorate and amongst consumers. And that's what I really fear with the anti-vax movement. And, you know, I think to tie everything together, since you do have to go, I'd love to just quickly hear your take, because my concern is that the points that you make are so profound and so important, but I would hate to just leave it at this with listeners going, oh shit, I'm never going to take a COVID vaccine then. Based on everything you said, I'm scared shitless now of the scientific process, and I would not want to take a vaccine against COVID. That, you know, that we're talking about two very different things here, are we not?
Well, I mean, I have to say, I mean, I hear this one, but I don't think there's as big a problem as you think. I mean, the sort of I say this in my book, the what Tom Wolfe, the writer, the architect of what used to be called the new journalism, used to talk about the literary gentleman with a seat in the grandstand. As the kind of people who do a lot of writing. And as I say, I mean, a lot of books about vaccines and, in fact, pretty much all of them, almost all of them, I can think one that possibly isn't, about vaccines and scientific method and what have you, are like that, people who hold forth. And the people who are holding forth at the moment, and you see them in the media, the same names keep reappearing again and again and again. And these are the people who monopolize the punditry on all this, and they raise all sorts of issues of the kind you're sort of alluding to. But I don't see it that way at all. I mean, having spent years and years looking at the specific facts and the real people behind these things, there are two things that motivate, that have had an impact on public attitudes, in particularly the MMR scare and the one before it. One is the information. So the diphtheria tetanus pertussis scare of the 70s and 80s collapsed when there was a big lawsuit where ultimately the judge was in London, not in the United States, where the legal system never really processed this one terribly well, but gave factual information that led the story to come to an end. This was the days of big media, where journalists such as myself and television producers and people in the institutionalized newspaper and media business could just say, oh, well, okay, that one's been dealt with, and move on to something else. And you don't get that now today with social media,
right?
Because they're not obviously subject to the same kind of controls. But when fact comes forward and the public recognizes the fact, such as that Wakefield was working for lawyers, I mean, when that happened, the British public, you could practically hear it out. You practically open the window and hear everybody going, "Ah, I get it now." Once you realize that, I get it. You know, so
but that didn't happen here.
No, but so hard information. Well, it kind of did, but I honestly can't go into it. There was a fight back from the anti-vaccine movement where Wakefield took up a different. The story goes on when you see what happens. But the other thing that would persuade people to vaccinate was when they saw disease outbreaks and they realized that their children were at risk of measles or of diphtheria or whooping cough or whatever it is. And so it may well be that a whole bunch of people, that whatever the latest percentage of people who say, I'm not going to have the COVID-19 vaccine. Well, if that's what they feel, don't have it. You know, there's going to be plenty of people who are going to have it, and they're going to be in the queue before you. It's not as though there's going to be too much vaccine going around, or there's going to be doctors' offices or clinics or mobile clinics or people sitting around tapping their fingers and gossiping because no one's come in to have a shot. There's going to be a massive stampede. And if some people feel cautious, want to wait, well, let them.
Well, so long as they're waiting. I mean, that's my big concern, is because there is a certain number. You have to reach a threshold to get herd immunity with any disease.
Yeah, you do. But if it's true that the leading contenders are not, have 95% efficacy, mm-hmm. I mean, that is an astonishing figure.
It's astonishing.
It is just an astonishing figure. So, you know, if it was only a 50% efficacy vaccine, then you would be having trouble.
Right.
if what they're saying is true. Now, I don't know whether what they're saying is true, because, you know, the fact that they've done a phase 3 clinical trial does not of itself convince me that the outcome is going to be nearly as rosy as they're suggesting. But I don't think that matters, because those people who are slow to, I mean, firstly, we've got to recognize that they didn't have any trouble recruiting to this phase 3 trial. And they got tens of thousands in those, so they didn't have any trouble with that. So there's plenty of people out there wanting to get their shots. But the ones who don't will, I think, then begin to see that the disease is continuing to some extent through next year, assuming it all goes to plan. The disease will continue at a much lower rate, and they will see it start to fade out. And they'll go, oh, yeah, well, now I see it's actually gone down. Donald Trump will start saying, you know, it was him. He was the one. He invented the COVID and these, you know, the vaccine, and it was all him, and him and Mike Pence, you know, they were the ones who did it. And then people will get vaccinated, and people who become concerned. And if we do still have people dying on face down on ventilators and writing last messages to their loved ones who can't be in the room. If that's still going on towards the end of next year, I think those people will say, well, okay, you know, we now have a vaccine. I better have my shot. And they'll turn up and have it done. So
here's hoping. So I mean, I have to say, and maybe this is a dividing line that is the ocean, but the perspective of folks who are living here in the U.S., seeing the rhetoric on our televisions every day and seeing active interviews with people who have COVID and deny that COVID exists. People who have a diagnosis and say they still wouldn't get vaccinated, that concerns me. And so I just feel like, as somebody who is a public communicator of science running this podcast, I wouldn't feel comfortable signing off saying, get it if you want, get it if you don't, it doesn't matter, because I think it does matter. And I think you should get it.
I don't think I'm saying it doesn't matter whether you have it or not, but I'm not sure on what basis you can form the judgment that somebody else should get a vaccine. You choose for yourself and people over whom you have responsibility. But I don't see the. See, I somebody at the Sunday Times said to me the other day, oh, you know, what can we do to encourage people to vaccinate, take the vaccine? I said, well, it's not the function of journalists to encourage people to do anything.
And that's the difference between your work as a journalist and my work as a science communicator, I think. And that's, you know, that's a whole other conversation that we don't have time for. But yeah, my role is science advocacy to some extent. And so when it comes to a massive public health crisis, I do feel a personal responsibility to at least communicate the data as we understand it, communicate the facts, but also contextualize it in a way that promotes public health. And that's why I think, obviously, if you have a condition that prevents you from getting vaccinated, you have to do what your doctor recommends and be safe. But those of us who are healthy, and once we have a vaccine available that we also has gone through the, you know, the gamut and is shown to be healthy and effective, it's actually our responsibility to get vaccinated to protect those who are unable to.
Yeah, but the risk, ultimately, yes, the risk benefit profile of is not something I just think a lot of that is up for grabs. I think it will sort itself out.
Here's hoping. You have a lot of faith, and I appreciate that. Well, Brian, gosh, I mean, I learned an awful lot from you. I think that people who pick up the book are going to get the, you know, as you said, the true, true story in all of its horrendous detail, and really understand that this was not a passive problem. Anti-vax didn't happen by mistake. This was a dedicated, concerted, fraudulent movement. And, you know, there was real propaganda, and there was real intent here. And you really can't deny it once you dig into these pages. It's the doctor who fooled the world, science, deception, and the war on vaccines. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today, Brian.
Well, thank you, Kara. I enjoyed it.
Of course. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.